I've enjoyed playing here. This has been over 20 years that I've been coming to Royal Melbourne. This is the way golf should be played.
We love coming down under.
Look, it's phenomenal to play. The quality of the golf's been great. But the enthusiasm of the people has been the thing that's just been amazing.
Tier of courses that I'm willing to shave my neck for in Kingston Heath, Victoria. Get me out of bed to shave.
Especially somewhere like Australia in the Sand Belt, and I have so many great memories of being down there.
G'day and welcome to another episode of Australian Golf Passport. I'm Scott Warren. Joining me is Matt Molicar. And that first noise you heard was me opening a beer because it's a Sunday arvo and we're about to talk about one of our favourite golf courses. Matty?
Yeah, I'm really excited to talk with you, Scott. It's been a while since we've talked about a course and we've had this sort of on the agenda for a while, and good to be sinking our teeth into Royal Melbourne East, a course we played together earlier in the year.
Yes, it was great to have that refresher. I've been going through the pictures. It was a gorgeous, gorgeous afternoon in autumn. I think it was my third or fourth lap around East over a period of 12 years or so. Obviously, you've had infinitely more than that. But yeah, it was good to get refreshed and it's going to be good to chat about it. And I'm keen to ask you a few things as someone who knows it so well.
I reckon it's a course that's a bit overlooked. It really lives in the shadow of its big brother. And it's impossible to consider it in isolation. And then even when people do, they sometimes think of the multiple road crossings and have that as an automatic detractor of their experience and their views on the course quality. But it is a fantastic course. And oftentimes you'll look at lists of world top 100 layouts and East just sneaks in or just misses out. And to think that there's 34,000 courses on earth and East still fits into that top 100 bracket speaks volumes about its quality and its character. So lots to talk about today.
Now, as always, we do this for Angus and Grace Go Golfing. Angus and Grace Go Golfing in William Street, Paddington in Sydney. Obviously, Matt is also the distributor for a lot of great bespoke golf brands, similar in spirit to his own. Obviously, he's got great Japanese handcrafted wedges. He's got great club brushes. He's got head covers from, well, one free out here from Big Dog Golf. We love them. He's got the Angus and Grace no laying up range, obviously, but then at the core of it is the Angus and Grace Go Golfing range of clothes for on course and off course for men and for women. Matty had a call from Matt Burns earlier this week, very exciting, telling me about a new addition to the range that will be coming soon, and I think will make Angus and Grace something for even more golfers to consider putting in their wardrobe. So really exciting to see the brand expanding, and we really encourage you to, as we say, support the people that support us, and that's angusandgracegogolfing.com, Angus and Grace Go Golfing on Insta, and of course, yeah, in store on William Street in Paddington.
I'm looking forward to getting one of his long sleeve tops. I think he's got a collared long sleeve top that I've been eyeing off for a while, and I reckon spring's the time, early morning spring round. That'll be the garment of choice for me, I reckon. So,
very good.
Our only other little bit of news for the week that we were just going to delve into just before starting off on East was the stadium golf that we spoke about earlier in the year. Aussie Golf Quest, Carl, thank you for listening. He was very, very kind to me weekend before last. He'd had tickets in his hand to go to Marvel Stadium to do the indoor golf experience. And then I'm not sure if he just forgot the dates and had a clash or whatever it was, but he was up in Queensland, unable to use the tickets. So I went along and played the 9-hole course inside Marvel Stadium. Really, really neat experience. You tee off at ground level on 30 and 40 meter holes. You go up to the third tier and have some huge drop shot holes that are a little bit longer. Clubs are supplied for you. There's tailor-made irons there. They give you two balls per green. Greens are marked out on the turf of the playing arena, just painted little targets with flags in them. And yeah, it's a neat experience with the roof open and the skyline in the distance. It'll be one for the memory banks, definitely. And we've got some pictures to put up from that day. We had the sun shining through when we played. So yeah, that'll give people a bit of a taste.
I like the idea of taking, you know, something that's intended for one playground and putting it into a different one. You know, like golf in a football stadium. King Louis of France, Matty, used to hunt deer in the Louvre. He used on horseback. He would ride through the halls of the Louvre and they'd let deer loose and he'd hunt deer in the Louvre. And so I'm thinking like mashups of things you're meant to do somewhere, you know, for me as a kid, it was cricket in the house, despite mum's protesting that that wasn't where cricket was meant to be played. Yeah. I like the idea of just, you know, going somewhere completely random to do something that doesn't really belong there but works.
I'd had a little look through the underground car park at Royal Melbourne that's just about to open on the day of the Wildflower Walk. And so it's an empty, very clean concrete space. And I just kept thinking this would be the most amazing go-kart track. Just to set up some ripple strips and some witches' hats. And, you could have a hoot zooming through there. So
you should organise a Royal Melbourne go-kart meet. It's like the opposite, really, of the Wildflower Walk. Probably draw a different crowd, but.
Yeah, good young members thing, I reckon. You get a lot of them going to that. Mm. So,
all right. Charge a bit of entry for outsiders, Maddie, and you might recoup some of the cash that you guys have spent on that car park.
Well, I told a few people that we wouldn't pull any punches and that we would talk about the car park at some stage during an episode. So it's been a process, but it's opening is imminent. I think the fire department has to sign off and give us some sort of certificate of occupancy, and then we're there. So it's been a while, and a lot of expense, but hopefully worth it. It's an extremely impressive construction job. The landscaping above it's unbelievable, and it'll be really, really functional.
Yeah. And it's been a rubbish time since COVID to build anything. Like anyone who reads the news regularly sees headlines about building companies ceasing to trade. There's a lot of people with half-built houses and half-built commercial complexes and whatnot. So, you know, I guess in RM's defense, you're not the only organization that's had a challenge building something. I think, you know, the fact that you've got it finished is a good thing, because a half-built underground car park's not much good to anybody.
Very happy.
And, of course, the day that we're about to probably refer to a lot in March, those who listened to our episode just after that, we recapped it and we probably talked about it a bit with Tron as well. If this car park had been finished and in future you'd be able to just arrive in inclement weather and wander in very dry and very calm. So something to be said for it as well. Yeah. And that is, however long we just talked about the car park is longer than we intended to talk about the car park. So let's stop talking about the car park.
It is. Let's talk about East.
So you're gonna play historian for us here. I think it's a good way to set up what East is and how East came to be. There's, I think, some misunderstandings of the timeline of East, who was really involved in designing and building East. Obviously, anytime Mackenzie's anywhere near anything, people want to falsely credit him with it. So why don't you know, we talked in episode 3 about Royal Melbourne West, and you talked to us about how the club came to set up at Blackrock after a couple of other locations earlier in its history. So why don't you go right back to how Royal Melbourne East came to be and who deserves credit for it?
So you mentioned Mackenzie. That's one for the drinking game bingo cards there, so you can already tick that off. Mackenzie came to Melbourne in late October 1926 and departed Australia on New Year's Day, and Royal Melbourne was in communication with the R&A looking for their recommendation as to who they should get to lay out a new course for them. And there was some possibility that it might be Harry Colt, but it ended up being Alistair Mackenzie. And the club Royal Melbourne owned a good portion of land, not all of that main paddock, but almost all of it. And the little portion of land that 13 through 16 West is played across already had holes on it at that time. So hanging up on the walls in RM's clubhouse is a 27-hole plan where Mackenzie had laid out West. And I'll put this picture up for those who are interested because it's a fantastic little look back at history. There's an executive 9-holer that's laid out around and within the confines of the West course using what land was available.
So on the land that's now 1, 2, 3, 4, 16, 17, 18 East or other land?
Yep, that's exactly it. Yeah.
So just that little anti-clockwise loop.
Yeah. And so there's whole corridors that run along 1 East, 2 East, 3 East, 4 East, 17 East. There's a little par 4 that sits between 3 West and 6 West, which you can't recreate now because of the dam being there, or the stormwater and irrigation holding. And sometime after Mackenzie departed Australia, I think it was 1929, one or two of the members really got on their bikes and investigated the possibility of acquiring more land on the east side of Reserve Road from multiple vendors under multiple titles, trying to keep it relatively low key so that they could acquire all of those parcels of land and not be held ransom or put themselves in a position where they held most and then were over a barrel trying to acquire the last one to make it all work. So West opened in 1931. I've gone back to a couple of club history books and also Dr. John Green's book on the courses of RM, which is a fantastic book. If anyone's out there and looking for a great book on the courses of Royal Melbourne, this is it. It's going to be very, very hard to find. You're going to pay hundreds for it, but if you can find it, grab it. I'll read a tiny bit from John Green's book. The idea of having two courses was not something that the club suddenly envisaged in 1929. Members had been suggesting the idea for some years. When Alex Russell was asked to provide a layout that incorporated the unoccupied land to the east of the 8th Sandringham hole, it's almost certain that he produced a scheme for 27 holes. In the late 1920s, the club held most of the land in the main paddock, and the club's intention was such. In addition to possessing a new 18-hole layout, there would also be a 9-hole short course. And again, that's what the plan up in the clubhouse demonstrates. In 1929, the cost of a new clubhouse was known, and many members felt that money would be better spent on a second golf course rather than spending it on a clubhouse, which is a very, very important and interesting decision for a club to have made, because that circumstance has probably popped up once or twice in RM's history and other clubs' history since, with St Andrews Beach being available and the potential exploration of other course and club acquisitions that have been declined. T.C. Trumbull, the son of a long-serving club council member, overcame several difficulties and privately obtained options over the land that lay east of Reserve Road, Black Rock. And this parcel of land is a good proportion of what East now sits on. So the council wrote to club members on October 14, 2 weeks before the stock market crash and Black Friday and the Great Depression, suggesting that the council was of the opinion that an opportunity to purchase adjoining land to provide for a second 18 holes would not come again, and that it's necessary for members to now give this matter their full consideration and determination. And they eventually did it. Russell, who had been devoted for years to seeing out the construction of West in Mackenzie's absence, and then the design and construction of East, was eventually made a life member of Royal Melbourne, an honorary life member, and Royal Melbourne East opened 18 holes in 1932.
Wow. So it took five, six years after Mackenzie's visit to finish building the West Course.
Yeah. So he left on New Year's Day 1927, and West opened in 1931.
Yeah, wow.
Which always surprises me. I never think of it as being that big a gap. And conversely, in the grips of the Great Depression, all of that land gets acquired for East, and then it opens within a 3.5-year period.
Mm. Well, and as context, you know, Mackenzie visited New South Wales in 1926, and it was opened by 1928. Now, granted, it was bunkerless, and it was probably a much more rudimentary course than the course that Royal Melbourne built from his plans. But yeah, that is quite a long time. But I think what you just given us kills very clearly this suggestion that, okay, maybe outside of some of what he might have suggested for the holes that were executive course holes on the main paddock, RM East is not got anything to do with Mackenzie, because the club hadn't even identified the land that East is built on predominantly until 3 years after he moved on.
Correct.
Yeah.
Russell spoke at that AGM where the council were addressing members on the issue of whether or not they proceed with this second 18. And his words are recorded. Russell had said that a first-class 18-hole course could be constructed by using some of the 9-hole course marked out on the club's present area in conjunction with the new land. So there's no surprise as to why those two rooms adjacent to the main bar at RM are named the Russell Room and McKenzie Room, and that top room upstairs now bears the name the Morecambe Room. I think in the last 20 years, the contribution of Alec Russell to the club has only been more and more realised, and people now look to his courses like Karrinup, Paraparumu Beach, Yarra Yarra, now that it's got its mojo back, and Riversdale to some degree. They realise that Russell was a fantastic architect.
Yeah, and so what sort of course did Russell build the club? It's different to West. You know, it is, it's stylistically, it's quite a different golf course.
It is. It's always felt a bit more exacting to me and a bit tighter.
Yep.
That land on the outer paddock. So for those who've never been, or for those who haven't yet looked at the Instagram pictures that we put up, you start on Royal Melbourne's main paddock when you play east, and you play the first four holes, and then you cross Reserve Road. And you play on a little second paddock, you play holes 5 and 6, and then cross another little quiet residential road and go play a third and final paddock, which holes 7 through 14 sit on. Make that same little road crossing to come back to 15, cross Reserve Road to play the last three on the main paddock. And that outer paddock, it feels very different to the main parcel of land that West sits on and that the composite course sits on. It's flatter. It doesn't have that richness of texture of the understory of vegetation. Its soil is even a tiny bit different. I don't think it's quite as sandy.
Yep.
And it's probably characterized by having taller trees, more numerous trees. It definitely feels different. There's still some movement to it, but it doesn't have the grandeur of those West holes.
Yeah. I would even go a little bit more specific than that and say that I feel like, so that back paddock is quite like north-south in alignment. And I feel like the holes that are on the northern end of that paddock, so basically 10, 11, 12, you know, they're very, very close to 17 and 13 at Victoria. And I think even they might be a bit sandier and a little bit more undulating, but it's really that south side of that paddock. You know, you've got 7, 8, 9, 13, and 14. And I think that's the bit that feels a bit squeezy and feels a bit constrained and compromised on that course.
What's interesting you say that, because Martin Hawtree served as consultant architect to Royal Melbourne for a short time and was assisted by Tony Cashmore a little bit on the ground during that tenure. Most of what Hawtree did for the club was investigate safety and boundary issues. And one of the main changes that he made was shifting the seventh fairway away from all the residential boundaries on the right side of that hole. And so everything sort of shifted to the left as you stand on the tee and look at that hole. And I think there's probably a 10 to 15 meter move in the eighth fairway as well towards the ninth, so that there's really only a relatively narrow stand of trees that separate the eighth and ninth fairways.
Yeah.
That used to be a bit more generous, that buffer between the two holes.
Yeah. I did some measurements earlier, and so 5, 9, 12, and 15 on the east course. So 5 being obviously on the middle paddock, and then 9 and 12 being on the far paddock, and then 15 again back on the oh, sorry, not 15, 14. So 5, 9, 12, and 14 all have sub-50-metre clearances from the trees on the right to the trees on the left. That's, you know, they all play through sort of little shoots. You know, they might widen out at various points, but that is very kind of un-Royal Melbourne. And even, as you mentioned, 7 and 8 share fairway for quite a bit, and it's 120 metres from the right side of 7 fairway to the right side of 8 fairway playing back the other way. So it's as wide as 1 and 18 at the old course in St Andrews, but somehow it still feels tight.
There's just something about feel that. Like that.
Yeah, there's just something about that little piece of land that, yeah, it's. I don't envy Hawtrey. I note that since Tom Doak became the consulting architect, he hasn't come in with a silver bullet and fixed that. And I think one of the things that, so bingo cards out, because I'm about to talk about New South Wales. I remember when Doak was engaged and he was our consulting architect, yeah, he said that he didn't want to work on the sixth hole first, because invariably when you get signed up to consult on a course, the reason that the holes that have had three or four goes at fixing them have had three or four goes at fixing them is because there's not an easy way to fix them. And I suspect that Doak's smart enough to have not even tried really to do that with 7, 8, 9 on East, because there's just not, like, fundamentally there's not enough land, and that's why it doesn't feel big enough. So yeah, I'll get Matt Mulliker's golf architect brain going a bit later with a couple of questions I've got for you about that. But certainly that is, you know, you start on grand spaces and undulation, you know, great land for golf and plenty of it on the main paddock. I feel like it slips away from you as you get out to the ninth hole. Then you get back into some of that from 10, 11, 12, even 13. You know, it doesn't need a lot of land, so it doesn't feel too squeezed. But then 14, 15, you walk in single file again, and then you're back on the main paddock and it's grand again. I mean, there really is kind of a flow and a change to the round.
It's interesting to think about that. As one of the pages in Dr. John Green's book, he talks about Russell and his philosophy and the character of the course. And he says, there's one type of change, however, of which Alec Russell would have strongly disapproved. While Russell used trees to shape and provide strategy to his holes, the practice of allowing trees to spread into aerial bunkers runs contrary to his philosophy. We know this on account of the following excerpt taken from a letter he wrote to the secretary of Lake Carinup in 1928. Russell wrote that the fairways shown are perhaps unnecessarily wide and the total cleared should be sufficient for all time. Trees are a poor form of hazard and nuisance on account of fallen leaves, and I have therefore shown a large width between trees on all fairways. Mostly, this has not happened at Royal Melbourne. Trees form corners as correctly intended. Yet there are some trees that have intruded into the line of play. History has demonstrated that no one is prepared to remove such trees or cut them back until they reach the stage of being a distinct risk to the safety of the membership. This is a universal problem, not one confined to the Royal Melbourne Golf Club, writes Dr. John Green. So, yeah, you can see that little change on East. You definitely feel hemmed in on 9 as well. 9's a long, skinny green on East, and it's an exacting approach, but even the tee shot's really exacting. You've got to – can't go too far left. Really got to be very courageous to go a long way down that fairway, and the tree limbs only ever seem to increasingly intrude from the right side while you're on that tee. So,
yeah. So obviously the scale being smaller in terms of the corridors – is mirrored at RM East by the scale being smaller of the hazards. It's obviously got smaller land movement. It's got some smaller greens with less going on. One of the things that I really notice that's different is almost a complete absence of driving bunkers at RM East. Obviously, West is covered in them. There's, from by my count, 11 of the 14 holes have, you know, fairway bunkering, and often it's a big feature of decisions on the tee. On East, it's really, you know, 4 or 5 holes have a drive bunker. The rest of them create the interest off the tee different way.
Yeah, you're right. You really need to think about line and club selection on several of those tee shots, starting even on the main paddock with the second hole. And that extends all the way through. 9 is another of those holes. 12 is another of those holes. 14, there's a solitary drive bunker on the left side that doesn't tend to worry most players. So
I measured that. It's like 120, 130 meters off the tee. So, like, yes, there are some people who that will be interesting for, but it is largely a, you know, what they might call in the old days a top shot bunker.
Yeah, it's more decorative than anything else. Having said that, I'll probably find myself in it in the next 5 rounds. One little nugget that I came across while I was looking at all of the history We talk about the composite course being put into play from 1959 for the Canada Cup to keep all of the gallery and players from undertaking any of those road crossings. The Australian Open of 1953 and 1963 were played over the East course, and the PGA Championship was played over the East in 1983. One of the other club history books that I referred to in the prep for today's episode, in 83, the visiting professionals were full of praise for the course, and many expressed the view that they had enjoyed the East even more than playing the composite course.
You know what they say about golf, pro golfers and architects of judgment. There you go.
That's probably equity of penalty. Had to be straight.
But it is different. Like, it is a very different golf course. And I like that it's not just a less good version of the West. That would be, you know, that would be a shame. That would be something that wasn't particularly compelling in its own right. I mean, I'm aware that there's a lot of members that are quite happy to go out and play the East because it's a different kind of challenge. It's maybe a little bit more forgiving. You know, it's penalizing in different ways, but maybe not in the most, you know, capital punishment of ways that West can be. It's great that the club's got two very different golf courses.
Yeah. Yeah. If you had like a West and a West Light that no one was particularly interested in playing, they thought, oh, I might as well just go to the one West tee and get the real thing. Then it's not good. It's a fantastic thing that they're complementary and they've got distinctly different character.
Yeah.
Talking about those previous histories, I teased it out in an exchange with you and Clates when we were texting earlier in the week, and I've refrained from mentioning it. Do you know who won the 1963 Australian Open?
I don't. I'm going to guess just based on you two were knowingly discussing some story that I've never heard in my life. Was it Gary Player?
It was.
Now, I want you to tell us about how Gary Player got to that tournament, because I gather that there's some ridiculous story attached to that.
So I'll preface it by saying that when Palmer and Player and Nicholas came to Australia, they were invariably playing with brand new clubs and they were fulfilling a Slazenger sponsorship or a Spalding sponsorship or some other sort of club and ball sponsorship that would have given them tens of thousands of dollars for a multi-week stay down here when they'd played a few events. So in the week prior to the 63 Australian Open, Gary Player had participated in the World Cup in Paris, which had finished on a Monday. It had been delayed 24 hours because of fog in Paris. So Player flew Paris, New York, LA, Hawaii, Auckland, Sydney, Melbourne. He arrived at Royal Melbourne at 10 o'clock on Thursday morning, was given his new clubs and was playing with a small ball, had never seen Royal Melbourne East, and won by 7.
Holy shit. Wow. Can we just recap that flight? It was Paris, New York.
New York, LA, Hawaii, Auckland, Sydney, Melbourne.
Wow. And he arrived Thursday morning. Tournament started Thursday.
Yep.
Clubs you've never seen before. Small ball. Wowee.
So small ball, another point of context for people who don't know. We play with balls that are 1.68-inch diameter at the moment, and golf was played decades ago with a ball that was 1.62 inches in diameter across the Commonwealth and under countries that were ruled by the RNA. And the game was bifurcated for a while, and then eventually countries outside North America embraced the larger ball. And in doing so, got a 20-yard handicap because the small ball flew further.
Yeah.
So the game was bifurcated previously. There has been a rollback previously, but how's that by Gary Player?
Yeah. Yeah, I picked up some old clubs for a mate in Melbourne, and they were near me here in Sydney a few years ago, and I went to pick up the set of clubs he'd bought, and the old bloke I was getting them from said, oh, do you want all this stuff too? I don't want it. And in there was about 10 old small balls still in their individual boxes.
Oh.
And I was amazed even. I went out and had a hit with them, and I was able to hit like a persimmon forward with a small ball about 20 metres further than I can hit a modern forward with a Pro V. They just go forever.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Just went forever. Awesome. Yeah, not a small adjustment for Gary to make. That's remarkable.
Yeah, so I read that and then read it again and read it again, and I just couldn't believe it. So yeah, he was given a set of Slazenger clubs that he'd never used before, teed off in the afternoon wave on the Thursday, and won by seven.
Mm. Incredible. It does bring up a point that does get discussed a little bit. You know, we talk about the top players from America and Europe not traveling to Australia to play tournaments nowadays. And there are people who suggest, oh, they should just do it, you know, notwithstanding that the purses are tiny, the taxation's huge, and the travel's long. But you mentioned there in passing, these club deals that the big players from, yeah, well, players from South Africa, but from America had, coming out here was a really financially fruitful thing for them to do because it opened up an entire new sponsorship deal for them. So, you know, yeah, they came here a lot and we can applaud them for supporting our Aussie Open and turning it into really what a lot of people said was the fifth major for a long time. But, you know, they weren't doing it because they cared about growing Australian golf.
They were making good money. So Mark McCormack was representing them. Even in the 70s when Kerry Packer was bankrolling the Australian Open at the Australian, he was paying a lot of those guys, I think, $6,000 Australian at the time. And I'm not sure what the exchange rate would have been back at that stage or what the tax rate would have been at that stage. But yeah, they were making money, definitely making money. So,
and so the East Course that Russell built, is it structurally essentially the East Course that we know today? Tee and green locations, routing, all that kind of thing?
Yes. Yeah. The sixth hole, the par three, that once had a little more of a Redan-like feature to it, has moved to the west and moved away from the boundary line on the right side of the hole as you look at it from the tee. But it's the same length hole with the tee in a similar sort of position, green in a similar sort of position. To quote John Green again, while the courses remained very much intact until recently, there were some holes that were changed early. This particularly rings true of the 11th and 17th holes, and to a lesser extent, the 1st and 15th.
Wasn't there a homestead inside the dogleg on 11 that took years to...
Yeah, the last little bit of land on that outer east paddock that needed to be acquired, there was a little residence on that was on the beeline between tee and green. It's a largely wooded area off Wetherill Road now. You sort of walk around it and then bend back around to the right as you play the hole. There's an amazing bunker that I want Tom Doak to recreate on the 11th. I don't think I'm ever a chance to get it recreated. But I'll put a picture of that up as well because there was this enormous, enormous bunker short and right of that green that discouraged people from taking driver on that tee and flying it over the farmhouse. And the green that's depicted in that aerial photo from 1936 is the same size green that sits there today. And you can see that huge Sahara-like bunker short of the green is several multiples the size of the putting surface. So that presumably turned to turf through a combination of time and money required for upkeep, the somewhat redundant nature of that hazard with the acquisition of the house and probably the difficulty in maintaining courses during the Second World War as well. So it's an amazing picture. I'll put that up, black and white, of that huge bunker.
Nice. What do you feel? Well, okay, no, let's reorder this because I don't want to presume your views. I've got some quick questions for you about the course, which I think will flesh out some of the stuff that we want to get to. What's the best hole on East that's not on the main paddock?
Five, short par four. So you cross Reserve Road, which in that aerial looks like it's a horse track. It looks tiny, like this little thread. You'd never think that it carried tens of thousands of cars as it does today. But five's a super hole. Just a very subtly front-to-back sloping green, and you've got acres and acres of space to hit into, more room than you realise on the right, a little bit of the right side fairways obscured from view on the tee. And you've just got to be really exacting with your tee shot. Leave yourself a full shot in to control the spin into what's typically a more demanding approach than it appears. And you've also got to be coming in from the right position. If you hug the tendencies for so many people to hug the left side of that fairway with their drive and try and feel like they get closer to the putting surface, and it's no fun approaching most pins from there. You always see someone in the group just hit to the heart of that green, and because they haven't hit a great shot, or invariably because they haven't been able to generate enough spin, they'll just roll through, and so they're trying to get up and down from the sixth tee. So,
yeah, well, when we played in March, I played my third shot from the sixth tee. So even people who know what they should be doing, it's tempting to land one a little bit further back, chase a back pin, and, yeah, neck minute. Is 16 East the best par three at Royal Melbourne?
Oh, it might be. it's the most artistic. It's the one that probably, I don't think any hole generates oohs and ahs more than it from first time players standing there on the tee. I've entered the Lido design contest every year for probably the last 7 years, and a couple of them have been par threes, and I've repeatedly thought in the developmental phase of that project, how do I encompass something of that green complex and that bunkering scheme? How can I try and put that in my design? Because it's awesome. It's brilliant to look at. And I've seen in prep for this episode that Ben Crenshaw comment. He talks with Tom Doak and says, I can't believe we just walked past the prettiest par three that I've ever seen. We're not even playing it. Lee Jansen said the same thing to him on day one of practice for that 98 President's Cup. I was standing near them and Lee just couldn't believe that they were walking straight by that hole.
I mean, it's the best par three on East. It's better than 5 West. It's better than 13 West. So it would have to be either 7 West or 16 West that trumped it.
Yeah, that was my thought. It was either 7 or 16 that was going to knock it off its perch as being the best. And to put some context around that, when you talk about it being better than 5 West, we've been in discussions with mates lots of times about how you just play the same shot to 5 West all the time and you just want to be in the middle of the green and you take your medicine if there's a front pin and you've got a downhill 25 footer for birdie. On those other holes that we consider in our chats as being better holes, we really talk about different shot shapes and different clubs and different targets depending on the pin and the wind from day to day, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, that's, I think, beyond the visual fancy, that's what makes a hole a great hole is, you know, and 16 East is almost like, it almost is a hole with two greens. It's just that the greens, yeah, maybe the right 10% of one and the left 10% of the other are joined and are green. But if the pin's back left versus front right, yeah, completely different holes with essentially two different greens. The bunkering sets that up really nicely, the way that it eats into the shape. It's really an interesting hole, downwind or into the wind, different shots. I think, too, I like par threes that are a longer par three, slightly downhill. I think in a win, being able to hit a trajectory.
Yeah, that's a really neat part of playing a par three. And as a designer, if you build a hole like that, you're able to ask that question of everyone. Longer holes, you might want a greater percentage of players having to ponder that sort of approach shot, and they're so far back that they just can't. But on a tee for a par three, particularly that forward and right tee that you walk by so oftentimes when you walk on that path across Reserve Road and towards commencement of play on the 16th, there's a little tee on the right, and then most of the time you play one that's a little bit further back and to the left. But yeah, flighting something, if the pin's on the left half and you're on that front right tee, yeah, it's a great fun shot, really neat shot to hit.
Okay, next question. Royal Melbourne famously has had a small amount of great custodians who've overseen the courses and maintained them. A lot of people would agree that it probably maximises potential better than maybe anywhere in Australian golf, maybe aside from Kingston Heath. So given that all of those things are true, how the hell is that tree on the right side of 3E still there?
It's got to go. I think it'll go at some point. It was front and center in my mind while I was reading that bit, that little passage from John Green's book. That's another one of the photos that I've got in that little folder ready to go when we put Instagram images and Twitter images up after this episode or in the lead up to this episode. There's a tree that's not that good looking for those who haven't played the course or haven't seen it. And it's on the inside of the third east hole, which is a downhill dogleg right par four. And you can legitimately be on fairway cut on the right side of the fairway with probably a 7-iron in hand and think, I can't see a square foot of the putting surface because this tree blocks my view.
If I remember correctly, I've got a photo of you from a few years ago trying to hit a snap slice 7-iron from around it. I might have to dig that up and post it.
Yeah, I've done that before. I've tried to punch hybrids along it and run them along the ground towards the front edge of the green. I think Rob Williamson put some footage up from the Bicentennial Classic or maybe another tournament even earlier than that. And there's a cherry picker view down onto the third east green, and you can see the gallery on the right side of the third east hole, and there's guys that are about our size, presumably, and the tree's there, and it's no taller than them. And I found myself just wishing that someone just leant on it or put a right foot on it back then. So it's grown into a behemoth. It's got to go.
All right. But anyway, RM East is ranked in the Golf Australia magazine ranking pretty consistently about seventh in Australia. Is that too high? Is that too low? Or is that correctly placed?
My gut feel is that it's about right. I remember when I first got onto that panel and Trevor Grant was a part of that Golf Australia ranking panel, along with a few architects and a few players. He had West East 1 and 2. And I remember thinking, hang on, what's this guy doing? Mind you, this is 20-something years ago. So it's pre-Barnboogle. It's obviously pre-Wickham and Lost Farm and lots of others. But he had East 2nd. And as time's gone on, I can see why he did that. I've been in a never-ending discussion with a mate regarding the virtues of East in comparison to Kingston Heath. And so to him, they seem like a natural pair to compare because they're flat sites. They have some great holes. They're built around the same time. And there's interesting little contrasts as well. So Kingston Heath's around that neck of the woods.
So in the latest ranking, Kingston Heath is 6th, I think, and East is 7th.
Yeah. Yeah, I reckon that's fair.
Oh, sorry, the Heath might be 5th. PK North was 6th and RM East was 7th, but similar ballpark. So then leading on from that, does RM East suffer from its association with RM West? Or is it flattered as a result of its association with RM West? Because it kind of goes one of two ways, I think. I think the second course at a club can be better than people give it credit for because it's the little brother. But then also sometimes I think, you know, Prince's being next door to Royal St. George's, for example, people include them in the same breath when really they ought not to.
I think it's probably a tiny bit better than most people realise. Like if you consider its high points in isolation, 1, 2, 4, 16, 18, the strengths of the outer paddocks, or the little gems that are dotted throughout the outer paddocks, there's some fantastic highlights there. It probably gets neglected by some that think, oh well, I'll go and play West, and that's all I'll do, and they don't see East. I think they just they focus on the Mackenzie course and probably should try and play both, which is the great thing about what we did that day in March. You think, okay, well, I can play all of them in the one day and then have the differences and the strengths and the contrasts fresh in my mind.
Yeah. I think people overlook sometimes how much of East is on the main paddock. You know, it's 7 of the 18 holes are on the main paddock. They have space you know, they're grand. It's really maybe half the course, you know, that suffers from the limitations that we've been discussing. You know, there's a lot of courses that would kill to have five or six of the holes that RM East has. And maybe it does have low lows and high highs compared to, say, Kingston Heath is a comparable course. Kingston Heath, much more consistent. We said the same thing comparing KH to Barnbougle Dunes a few episodes ago, but it's maybe even more telling between RM East and Kingston Heath that Kingston Heath would kill for a couple of holes of the quality of RM East, but there's nothing as low as the lows on East when you go to Kingston Heath.
I think that's a fair comment. Yeah. What are your favourite holes on the course?
Well, so I think One East is an opener in Aussie golf that people overlook and sleep on. I think it's a great drive and pitch hole. I think it rewards smart play. That green sliding off the hillside is just beautiful. To me, that's one hole that I'm really excited to play. You've talked about five being a really great drive and pitch hole. Again, I think if 3 West wasn't a few hundred meters away, people might enjoy and enthuse more about 5 on East. I think 10 East is a really magnificent short 5. I love the bunkering. I think it's between it and 17 East. I think they have the smartest bunkering of the par 5s at Royal Melbourne. You know, they make you think things about those second shots. If you can't get there in 2, you're really having to think about where you position yourself with your layup, which a lot of par 5s don't really do. If you can't get there, it's just bunk something into wedge range. I am a huge fan of 13 East. I mean, we talk a lot about those sorts of holes on this podcast. They could literally be built on any acre and a half plot of land, really great green that I think gets it a bit over its twin brother over on the East course. And then the finish of 16, 17, 18, and we'll get to an exercise that I've got for you, but that last 45 minutes of the round, I just think is fascinating golf. It's super fun. It's beautiful. It's varied. I think from go to woe, there's a very good holes on the golf course. And I think maybe one of the limitations of East is that, you know, you might look at 3, 6 through 9, 12 and 15 are the lesser holes. It's probably a shame for East that they are dotted fairly consistently through the round. And so you never really get that momentum up like you do on West, or, you know, where you're front 9 at Barnbougle Dunes, where you're just getting great hole after great hole after great hole after great hole. There's always a little tap on the brake on East, but I think the best on East is magnificent.
Yeah, that's really well described, because you get I had an image just while you were speaking of a surfer on a wave, with a wave growing and growing and growing, and it sort of grows and then plateaus on East, or it might dip and then, oh, hang on, it's picking back up again. Oh, no, it's going back down again. It does. The rhythm of the course does do that.
So I want to get you to be my judge on something.
Okay.
And we're doing a hole-by-hole match between West and East.
Okay.
Now, I haven't gone 1 versus 1 right through 18 versus 18, but I've tried to keep the holes relatively close in order, because I think where a hole falls in the round is sort of part of its value. We've talked about 1 West being a good opening hole, but not a good hole. So 1 through 18 on East, and I've paired them up with holes from the West that I think are pretty similar and occur in a similar part of the round. Because ultimately, the West course at Royal Melbourne is one of the consensus best, probably 7 to 10 courses on earth. And so being hailed in comparison to that is no insult. But I just want to get you to tell me the first thing that comes to mind for your answers. Okay. And half holes are perfectly fine. And so I want to see where we end up. So 1 East versus 1 West.
East.
2 East versus 2 West.
Halved.
3 East versus 6 West.
6 West.
4 East versus 5 West.
5 West.
5 East versus 3 West.
3 West.
6 East versus 7 West.
7 West.
7 on East versus 4 on West.
4 West.
8 on East versus 8 West.
Halved.
9 on East versus 9 West.
9 West, I'd go with. Yep.
So far, this is sort of how I expected it to go.
Okay.
We're on the back now. So all the front 9 holes were on the front. All the back 9 holes are on the back in terms of the comparisons. 10 East versus 12 West.
10 East, which we probably should have put in as our short five.
I was thinking that. That was a miss.
That was an oversight. We've got a lot of... Got a lot of taps on the shoulder in the last week.
Yeah, we missed out on stuff. Own that.
So those Gazetta, just to digress for a moment, those little Gazetta or catalogue episodes where we talk about the best short three, short four, short five. So I think we might be doing something else like that on the back of the amount of feedback and the amount of interest that listeners expressed after that. So
11 East versus 14 West.
11 East. 14 West. Halved.
Right. 12 East versus 11 West.
11 West.
Okay. That's it. That's the first one you surprised me with. 13 East versus 13 West.
I'm going to go 13 West.
Because you aced it. 14 East versus 15 West.
15.
15 East versus 10 West. I don't even need to ask that question.
No. That's
10 West.
Yep.
16 East versus 16 West.
Halved.
17 East versus 17 West.
West.
And 18 East versus 18 West.
I'll go halved. I'll give East a little push along there.
Okay, so that didn't go exactly how I expected it to. But I felt like there was a lot of thoughtful silences before you chose holes on West. You know, there might have been a lot of narrow wins, but basically we've ended up 11 holes on West that you've chosen.
Okay.
But I mean, I guess if we look at it, 7 out of the 18 holes, you don't think West is better than East. Now that's, you know, as we say, when we're looking at a top handful in the world sort of golf course.
And that's almost notable. Half the holes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And a couple of those West wins were line ball things. Like you could easily give 13 to East instead of West.
Yep.
There's one or two others that were close there too. So,
now based on an answer you just gave and a mission you made when you were talking through the great holes on East earlier, I get the impression you're maybe not as fond of 17 as I am.
No, I like it. I really do like it. It's changed in the last 15 years. That was one of the other material changes that Hawtrey's safety audit resulted in. And so that fairway too has moved away from the course boundary and from Reserve Road, and that tree buffer between Reserve Road and the right edge of the fairway as you play up 17 has become infinitely more densely treed. And that diagonal bunkering that you were talking about earlier in that second shot landing zone has changed. So for those who haven't got a history on the course that goes back 20 or more years, there was a diagonal string of bunkers that ran all the way from long right that almost seemed to integrate with the right greenside traps to the left side of the 17th fairway. And you just had to make a decision with your second shot. At what point do I cross these? Do I go left and cross them sooner? Do I go right and then negotiate them with my third? The further I go down the right side of the fairway, the smaller that landing area becomes. Where's the pin? What's the wind doing? Do I want to be right or left? How good was my drive? What club have I got in hand for the second shot? And some of that has changed. So that diagonal string of bunkering in that second shot landing zone on 17 East has sort of been curtailed early. The ones on the left side were filled in so that there was room away from the boundary so that if there was any sort of doubt or any sort of concern, players can just play a second shot left and never endanger the fence line. Doak, when he built that new back tee on 2 West, raised that tee slightly and integrated some sand into the the southern side of that tee block. So when you're back in the fairway on 17, you look up and sort of see this continuation or a hint of a diagonal line. But once you've played it once, you know that they're way in the distance. They're not where they should be, so to speak. So I'm probably wedded to the idea of the old hole, Scott. I really enjoy playing it, and it's at that part of the round where I think I want to get 3 points on this hole. I want to hit some good shots. I want to get a good drive away, and it keeps you honest. Particularly in a north wind, it definitely keeps you honest. It's a good hole, but comparing it to 17 West, like, doesn't work. But 12 West, they run in a similar sort of direction. They're a little different in that 12 West's way more gettable. You're coming in with something short for your second shot oftentimes. But it is a good hole.
Kind of answered de facto this question already. You're given carte blanche to change East. What do the Matt Mollica changes look like? I suspect they include the bunker on 11 and restoring those lost bunkers on 17. What else jumps out to you, and removing the tree on the right of three? Apart from that, is there anything else that you see on East that you think, geez, it'd be nice to?
I'd greedily like a tiny bit more room on the right side of the second fairway. No, there's not many changes. I think the little things that I would do are what you've said. The tree on the right of three East has definitely got to go. I'd try and undo some of the Hawtrey changes to 17 with that fairway bunkering, but I mean, you're creating a huge liability issue by doing that now, because anything bad ever happens, you seem to have gone against a published safety audit that was embraced 20 years ago. So I'd need to be mayor of Black Rock to get that through.
Well, maybe you could become mayor of Black Rock and then close Reserve Road and sell it to the golf club.
It's interesting, the criticism regarding Russell and the boundary issues on East, with the course going counterclockwise. So just playing with that boundary fence on the right side of two, the right side of three, the right side of four, the right side of 17. You look at that black and white aerial from 1936, and there's fairway bunkers to the right side of the fourth green that are way wider than Reserve Road is. Like, Reserve Road sort of looks like it ends almost at Park Road, that road that Victoria is off.
Mm-hmm.
So if you said to Russell, look, in 80 years' time, or 90 years' time, this is going to be a pretty busy suburban arterial. You can't have golf balls coming near this. He would have looked at you like you were out of a spaceship. So I've never really lent too hard into the criticism of him on that front. Mm.
It is interesting you point out. So 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 10, 11, 12, 14, 15, and 17 either have homes or a road immediately to their right.
Yeah.
That's a lot of the golf course.
With the predominant demographic of recreational golfers being right-handed slicers. It's 12
out of 18 holes.
Yeah. And so they were some of the changes that Hawtrey made. That's why 6 moved. That's why 7 moved. That's why the right side of 17 is planted more heavily, which is understandable in this day and age.
Yeah. I think it does get forgotten a bit with West being West, but I'm always surprised when I go back to East by just how good it is, how fun it is, how incredible the good holes are. 7, 8, 9 might be a little bit of a disappointment, but it's over and done pretty quick in the middle of the round. And I think you play it in the afternoon, you come home 16, 17, 18 into the setting sun. As some videos that we took in March will attest, it's a pretty incredible experience.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a grand finish. Certainly walking up 18, it's a big, big green complex and expansive bunkering, and the clubhouse off to the right. Sun sort of making its way down when you play that hole late in the day. It's a beautiful setting.
What's your 10-round split, West versus East?
I'm probably more of a sucker for West than most people would be. I'd probably be 7-3.
Yeah. it feels like an insult, but that's just kind of a comment on how freaking good West is. But 7-3 is probably the right answer.
Yeah, it's probably a comment. Yeah, it's more a commentary on what you're longing to play on that other course when you're going around East. You think, oh, I could be hitting this. Oh, I could be. Yeah, you're pining for some of those highlights on the West course. Not an indictment of East per se.
All right, my notebook's empty. How about you?
I was going to comment on one or two tiny little changes that Doak's made in the time that he's been there. We haven't really talked about 15 at all, and 15's an obvious topic to start on, I suppose, when we talk about Doak's influence. Tom Doak's been the consultant at RM for probably more than 12 years. He's done a lot of little things that could probably escape detection. He's expanded short grass aprons around a lot of greens. He's done functional little things like ball washers and drinking fountains and sand buckets out of the line of sight while you're on the tee and looking up the hole. 15, that drivable or reachable four on the back of East, had one attempt, then the next, then the next, then the next under Hawtrey's tenure. That probably was the area where most balls were going over the boundary fence more than any other hole on the property.
It's only 255 front edge, so it's properly drivable.
Yeah, and most people with a north wind, people would think I could just launch something high and draw it back onto that green. Certainly under the previous iterations of that green as well. And so it bears very little resemblance to the hole that was there 20 years ago. Tom was probably far more sophisticated and far more successful than Hawtrey in moving play away from a fence line. So we removed a little bit of vegetation between 5 and 15 and created acres and acres of space out to the left, internal to the property and not down the fence line. Put a little bit of bunkering on the right side to make it less of an attractive looking line to the green. And he also severely tilted the green from front to back. And so he's dictated that you need to hit a full shot with a lofted club and really generate a lot of spin to hold that green. And so you're automatically reaching now for something like a 4-iron or a hybrid rather than driver. And I think that's an eminently more palatable way to address the safety issues on that hole. And probably a hole that Tom could be really proud of. Now it holds its head amongst all of those other good holes on East, I think.
Yeah, that's probably the hole that in my playing of East spans the Hawtrey into Doak era. And certainly 15 and 6, I think, were the ones that head up in polite society kind of deal after Doak intervened. Yeah, 15 East is never going to be 10 West. But I think now it's a much more coherent Royal Melbourne hole than it was before.
Definitely, yeah. Yeah, some of that Russell philosophy is palpable as you play that hole. And it's probably a good interlude between that minor sense of confinement on that outer paddock and those last three where you cross Reserve Road and think, oh, I'm back into a big spacious environment. That's a 15 serves as a bit of an intermediate in that regard, which I don't know if Tom would ever have thought of doing that with the hole. I presume he didn't, but maybe he did have it as a bit of a midway between the two in terms of character. So.
Yeah. I think too, from like 12 home, is a lot of difficult golf, and 13 and 15 are essentially your breathers in that. You know, 12, 14, 16, 17 and 18, they're tough, mostly long holes for their par. So I think having, you know, an 8 or a 9 iron at 13 and then, you know, a hybrid and a gap wedge at 15 does break up the difficulty a little bit, which is nice.
It's grass the same as West. Sutton's Mixed Greens. Legend Cooch is becoming less and less of a percentage of the fairway area, with Wintergreen having taken hold and starting to become the predominant fairway grass out there. fescue collars around all of those greens. So when composite comes together, the east and west holes are really indistinguishable to the first time visitor.
I guess it makes it simpler for the course crew in that I know, say at National, they need to have machinery for each course so that grasses don't pollute, and they have, you know, different maintenance. I know there's clubs that have different grasses that even will do their coring and their dethatching and whatnot at different times of year. I guess that's the ease of the job for the crew at RM. And even, well, the same crew looks after sandy links, don't they? So they can just maintain all of their acreage the same way at the same time.
Yeah.
I know people don't like the visual of those fescue collars that Royal Melbourne employs, but in terms of playing golf, I think they're a better option than any kind of cooch up to the edge of the putting surface. In terms of the shots you can hit, the way the ball reacts when it lands short of the green. Yeah, look, it's, you're compromising one way or the other. And I guess I'd rather compromise aesthetically than I would in terms of playability.
Be interesting to see if they stay when wintergreen becomes really, really established and dominant. Because the wintergreen gets carried all the way. They're pure wintergreen fairways at Metro, and they get carried all the way to the putting surface.
Yeah. So
interesting to see if that ever happens. Having said that, Metro's greens aren't as firm as RM's. And when they are firm and they're quick, that respite, that ability to be able to land something on the fescue collar short, have a shorter club in hand, and think, okay, I can land this up, but not on the green. And I know it's going to bounce predictably and firmly, and that it's going to go forward onto that putting surface. It's a great thing to have in the back of your mind.
Yeah.
Great asset to the course.
Yeah. Even with wintergreen and firm sandy soil, I think November to March in Australia, there's, if you're landing an iron shot or if you're chipping and running, there's a grip on the first bounce that Cooch gives that fescue doesn't. And when I moved back from the UK to Sydney, it was something that I had to actively relearn, even if it's done as well as they do it at Metro. And everyone knows, obviously, Metro does maintenance and conditioning as well as anywhere in the world. I don't know. I think there's just something that no matter how much time and love and money you have, and how nice the conditions are to support that, Cooch can't compete with fescue for that type of... And again, it's a small thing in the grand scheme of things, but when you're separating the best courses in a country or on the planet, it's not insignificant.
True. Yeah, you start looking at those little one percenters and little points of difference. You're right. All right. I'm going to get to work editing this. Had some unstable internet throughout this last hour.
We have. I'm curious to see how that plays out, but I don't think we've ever pretended to be a highly professional, well-polished podcast, so we should be okay.
I think we'll be good.
Matty, it's been really good fun talking about this course. We've been threatening to do RMEs for a little while, and I've really looked forward to the chat, and I've enjoyed talking about the course with you.
Likewise. Next episode's probably another course, I think, as well, which will be good.
I look forward to finding out which one it is.